A4.
Number 13B.
Let's take another one. I don't tell you to which one I come now. She said, when error felt the power of truth. Huh? Can you see? When error felt the power of. Huh? Well, error is the counterfeit of truth. So she had to say, when error felt the power of truth, not the power of mind. Or this one, just to make it a bit more differentiated, 137.2, where she said that his students saw the power of truth heal the sick, cast out evil, and raise the dead. Or another one, so here you had the power of truth. Another one, 231.22, to fear sin is to misunderstand the power of, yeah, of fear is more accentuated than it is the power of love. Huh? If sin would have been accentuated, you see, then it would be the power of soul. But here, fear, to fear sin, huh? So that's the attitude, to fear something, and so it has to be counteracted by the power of love. Yeah? Can you see the combinations? So in the same way, for instance, if you would go through law, we say fundamentally that law is mind. That law is an idea characterizing mind specifically. It doesn't characterize spirit or soul or principle, life, truth and love specifically, though it is used with all the other synonymous terms. So when she speaks about the law of spirit, it is always when she speaks about the law of matter. So when the proposition is law of matter, then she has to counteract with the law of spirit. Or if she speaks about the law of death, well, then she has to speak about the law of life and things like that. Yeah, all right. You feel you got it. Huh? And I would naturally like to see that each one is thoroughly rooted in this method so that each one can stand up against the criticism of our analysis. So we go on to the next point, G, where we go still a step further, combining an idea with all ideas of all the ideas of the seven synonyms. I think this is not quite English, huh? I was writing it while somebody was talking to me. We actually should write combining an idea, yeah, with all the ideas, huh? All the ideas of the seven synonyms. That's better. We also call this in our phraseology blendings of idea. The blendings of idea. All right. What is meant by it? See, it's going still a step further than what we have been seeing. First we had, just to recapitulate, first we had the seven synonymous terms. Then we began to combine the seven synonymous terms, just as synonymous terms. Then, just now, we have taken one idea of one of the synonymous term and combined it with the other synonymous terms. And now we can go a step further and take one idea of a synonymous term and combine it not with the synonymous term, but with all the ideas of the seven synonymous terms. Yes? Which actually is that what we saw a few days ago when we had taken that illustration about the prism and the lens, you know? You remember that? When we could see that the lens would really take these ideas through the lens to the focal point of spirit, and when they gather into the focal point of spirit, that really then they bring out the full effulgence. That if we take an idea, not a synonymous term, an idea of mind, and combine it with ideas of spirit and ideas of soul and principle and life and truth and love, that they gather into the focal point and bring out light instantaneously. That is, they gather the full effulgence of what it is. I could put it into other words and could say that what we called an idea characterizing as one of the seven synonymous terms, like we had power, that actually only then power is understood as an idea when we see power reflecting all other ideas of all the other synonymous terms. Only then we have the fullness of the idea called power. Only then, now you can see, only then really the idea is as big as its principle. Only then the idea reflects all that the principle has. And before we can't see that, it is only a concept. That idea is not yet an idea. It still is only a concept which we entertain, which is not yet fully identified. The full effulgence of the idea is only brought out when we take an idea and consider it as reflecting all other ideas of all the seven synonymous terms. And that is the way we used to practice in the 40s when we didn't know more than that. And we used that in our practice year in and year out because we would see, oh, it's not enough just to see if the case would be a claim of power, of erroneous power, to say, well, there is only one power, and that's the power of mind. And mind is all power, and therefore there is no other power but mind. That was not enough, because we still had only a concept of power, and not the full effulgence of that tone. And we would only get the full tone of power if we would combine it, or blend it, as we said it, blend it with all the other ideas of the seven synonymous terms. And then each idea would reflect the whole, and it would be an idea of God. And so we must see also what Mrs. Eddy meant, really, that she said that principle is not to be found in fragmentary, is that the right pronunciation, fragmentary ideas. There is no fragmentary idea. If I have only power as a concept and don't see it as embedded, so to say, in all the other ideas of divinity, I have a very limited human sense of the term power. So in order to have to see power as idea, and the idea is always the idea of the infinite, I have to close, so to say, the idea with all the other ideas. And we could call that each idea reflects each other idea. That's another way of putting it. And so let's keep in mind, you see, that when we speak about the idea, say, of substance, the idea of law, or the idea of action, that we see that it is only then an idea when it reflects each other idea. Before that, it is just an atomistic concept. It has no relationship with all the other ideas. It has no gestalt. All right. So, in practice, what we should do, therefore, is to take any of those ideas that come to us as being the right idea, counteracting a specific illusion, and to take that idea and just contemplate them in their reflection. Say, if we had just before taken the idea power, or shall we take another one? All right, let's take intelligence. We see, for instance, intelligence is an idea that is characterizing the nature of God as mind, typically, intrinsically mind, that is not enough. That therefore, if we have a case where there is ignorance at stake, where somebody feels that they have not enough intelligence for doing something, and then we say, but dear, look here, you know, mind is all intelligence, and therefore all the intelligence is dependent on mind, and not on your human mind, and not on your brain, and not of your education, and not on your memory, but it's all dependent on the one mind that is all-knowing, all-wise, all-intelligence. Then we only have a atomistic sense of intelligence. But if we try to see it as an idea, then we would go on and reflect it through spirit and see that the idea also reflects ideas of spirit. Therefore, we could see, for instance, what? That an idea is spiritual. Take the easiest one. That intelligence That intelligence is spiritual. And that counteracts, you see, always take right away the counteracting. And that counteracts at once in us that it says, oh, that intelligence is dependent on brain, on matter. Because it's spiritual, it's not material, so it's not dependent on matter, not on brain. And you already take it away from the brain concept. Or you go further and combine it with an idea of soul, then perhaps we would see that intelligence is unchangeable, that it doesn't come and go. Soul doesn't come and go. So that you feel intelligence is unchangeable, therefore that intelligence which is needed is right here, as and there is not the question, will I then at that very moment when I need it have the intelligence, will the right idea come to me or not? Will I see it at that point? Or after, only after my examinations? Will I see it right then when I need it? If I see that intelligence is unchangeable, then I know it's always there. If I combine it with an idea of principle, for instance, what would I see about intelligence? Just to be very loose about it, you could just take it just the opposite and say intelligence is not dependent on person, it's impersonal. Intelligence is absolutely impersonal. It does not belong to people. It neither belongs to the teacher, nor to the student, nor to anybody. Intelligence is super-personal, supra-human. It belongs to the principle of being. And so one feels at once that that intelligence is not dwelling in a person. Or we take an aspect of life into it. What could we see in an aspect of life? That that intelligence is eternal, all right, timeless, indestructible. And we just can take these concepts into it and see that intelligence is eternal. Whatever there is to be known is something that exists in being, its beingness, its isness. That's what life is. So intelligence has not to be brought about, has not to be brought forth through a creative impulsion. It is isness, it is a state of being, of beingness. And if we consider intelligence from the point of truth, for instance, what could we see about intelligence? Something terrific, namely that intelligence has consciousness, that intelligence is conscious of itself, and that offsets the belief that I have to be conscious of intelligence. The moment I can see that intelligence is the intelligence of truth, that would be the combination, I see that that intelligence is conscious of itself. It's conscious of what it has to do, how it has to do, when it has to do, in which way it has to do. It's conscious of its knowing. And then I can combine it with love, with one or the other idea of love, whatever is adapted to the situation. You could perhaps see what that intelligence has planned, that intelligence works out the plan, that it doesn't act blindly, purposelessly, but that intelligence has a purpose, has a meaning. Therefore, there is no existential vacuum for intelligence, because it works out a terrific big plan which that intelligence knows. So that intelligence is plan, can you say planful, purposeful, has an aim, is teleological, so that you get the sense that intelligence is at work for a very definite aim and just knows how to arrive at that aim. Then we clothe, so to say, intelligence within all the qualities of the other synonymous terms. And then you feel that then when you think about intelligence, you just don't have a term, intelligence, just an atomistic sense of intelligence, but then you have a round, comprehensive, warm, big sense of what is implied with the term intelligence. So this is the way that we begin to use in practice these ideas. And So when one knows those ideas of all the seven synonymous terms, one can go quite systematically about it, one can be orderly about it, so that one leads thought naturally from one point to the other until one has a roundabout, a fulfilled sense of the tone of an idea. In doing that, you see, we will see, we must not forget something, namely that in doing that, we will have a dominant tone in it. The dominant will always be intelligence in this case. The intelligence will be the dominant, and therefore, in thinking it out, we will always repeat the term intelligence, whereas the combinations, the blendings, are no more the dominant. They are the subtones. So if I say intelligence is spiritual, then intelligence is the dominant, the main tone, and spiritual is the subtone. If I say intelligence is unchangeable, then intelligence is the main tone, unchangeable is the subtone. Yes? And if you know that, then you begin to understand Mr. Dorley's teaching, where he always speaks when he gives those talks on the Bible and gives the layout of one of the biblical books. He would always give the main tone and then give the subtones, when there are subtones. And those subtones can actually also be symbolized by the synonymous terms. And so we would speak in this case, we would speak that here is, in this example of intelligence, we would say, well, the main tone in it was mind, intelligence, and the subtones were spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, and love. And we have adopted as a convention, so to say, the rendering that we will call this mind as mind, mind as spirit. Always the as is then the subtone. So mind is the main tone. Mind as spirit, spirit would be the subtone. Mind as soul, soul would be the subtone. Mind as principle, mind as life, mind as truth, mind as love. So that we would have a convention among us that the first synonymous term means the dominant tone and the others are the subtones. How many minutes have I left? Oh, good. Now, you see, this spiritual mathematics is not something that we have invented. We only have defined it. But it is in the Bible and it is in the textbook, in both. Therefore, you have that situation that you have a book of the Bible, say, whatever you take, say, like Judges or Joshua or anything like that, and we would see that a whole book of the Bible may have a certain layout, and that that certain layout would have, say, seven main tones going from beginning to end, say, through the subject of mind, and then changing at a certain point, break, then going through the subject of spirit, and then through the subject of soul, and principle, life, truth, and love, and we come to the end of the book. But not only that, most books will be more detailed, and will do the very thing which we have been doing, namely, that it starts with mind as the main tone, and gives that main tone in seven subtones, as mind is mind, mind is spirit, mind is soul, mind is principle, life, truth, and love. And then go to the main tone of spirit, and show that in seven subtones, and then soul in seven subtones, principle, life, truth, each in seven subtones, so that mostly a book like that is being written out in seven times seven tones. A complete, neat, clear, balanced structure. And that's the great merit that John Dorley has, that for the first time, through the study of those synonymous terms, he could detect in the Bible such a structure, so that the Bible is no more a history where symbols have been put together more or less at random in order to put over an idea, but in order to put over that idea, they have followed spiritually an exact, balanced, systematic layout. And the very thing we have seen after John Dorley left us, we have seen in the textbook, that Mrs. Eddy was writing that spiritual mathematics. Say you take the chapter on prayer. The chapter on prayer just does not just talk a little bit about her concept of prayer and that she has another concept of prayer than theology has. But she gives a clear, nice, balanced layout, giving seven prayers as main tone, prayer of true desire, and then the second, the prayer of spirit as a prayer of spiritual quality, the prayer of soul, the prayer of principle, prayer of life, the prayer of truth, prayer of love, and each one subdivided in seven subtones. So that those that chapter of 17 or 18 pages, whatever they are actually a absolute neat matrix of 7 times 7. Absolutely ordered. And so you can see that the moment we have the spiritual ear of the tonality of those seven synonymous terms, we read the textbook completely different. We hear, so to say, the symphony of prayer in it. We don't anymore read passages and love this sentence and love that sentence. We love the whole thing because it's the whole symphony, and we just see the exactness and the systematic build-up and layout of that whole question of prayer, which has a great overtone of the Word as the Word. So, with this, I just wanted to bring thought to the point where we actually would be able, if we have the tonality of the synonymous term and know the spiritual mathematics of it, that then we would be able to read the Bible, the Old Testament, the New Testament, the textbook, in a completely new way, namely as science. Isn't that terrific? Who is thinking about these things?